Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The long-term benefits of exercise are obvious to most, but finding the motivation to stick with the routine, whether it's cycling, boot camp, or running or weights, is a struggle for many. Most researchers and increasingly employers and health insurance companies are working to solve that problem. Joining us now to discuss incentives for exercise is Mark Mitchell from the University of Toronto. He's also a cardiac rehabilitation supervisor at Toronto Rehab. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Do we have a sense yet for why it is so difficult for people to exercise more, even people that you work with who are in rehabilitation and are doing it to just get back to where they were?
Yeah, it's quite challenging to commit to a regular exercise program, even for people who have suffered from a catastrophic cardiovascular event. Eventually, the fear of having another event sort of decreases and the motivation wanes, and the everyday challenges that all of us experience when we're trying to engage in regular activity become more salient, more obvious, like the time you have to take out of a busy schedule to exercise, or up here in Canada, having to work around harsh, long winters, and, you know, visiting family and stress and those sorts of things. So there are a lot of obstacles, which makes it hard for even cardiac patients to commit to a program.
So it's not that we're just lazy.
No, I mean, motivation is definitely a factor. And so that's where the incentive piece comes in, because even if they're modest in size, it can, and if the incentive is meaningful enough, like a coffee card voucher, for example, to your favorite coffee shop, that might be motivation enough to get you going on a daily basis.
What types of different incentives have been tested and have been found to be successful?
Well, based on the literature review that we published yesterday in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, a lot of researchers and interventionists are using cash incentives, but also reimbursing people for their gym membership fees. So, for example, a popular incentive was the contingency was if people were to visit the gym and exercise 8 or 10 times in a month, then they would be reimbursed half the cost of that monthly membership or the entire membership. So that one in particular seemed to be quite effective for a couple of reasons, because it's relevant and it's an incentive is health related. It's perceived as being part of the solution as opposed to just a carrot or a bribe.
What about punishments?
Good question. The focus of our review was just on incentives, not disincentives. I'm not a fan of disincentives, I guess, from a philosophical perspective. Punishing those who aren't able to exercise regularly or lose weight, for example, because there's so many factors that come into play. And to punish people, for example, who are working 15, 16 hours a week or who don't have access to rec facilities and that sort of thing for not being active or losing weight is, in my opinion, unethical. And so I tend to favor the incentive approach.
My guest is Mark Mitchell. He is one of the authors of Financial Incentives for Exercise Adherence in Adults. It's a review and analysis of the literature on testing of incentives in exercise. It was published yesterday in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. How do you, listeners, get over the hump of exercise? How do you motivate yourself to exercise? Give us a call and share your strategy, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Is there a point where do we know about how rewards work, and that if there comes a time when you don't have to be rewarded anymore, exercise is its own reward?
Yeah, definitely. One of the main considerations in financial health incentive design, and one that's often ignored, is its impact on motivation to do certain things. So most people aren't intrinsically motivated to exercise. They don't enjoy it for the sake of doing it, like you might listening to music or going to the movies. But there is a motivation continuum, and you can either be on the very intrinsic end where you actually enjoy the activity, or on the extrinsic end where you're exercising, let's say, because you absolutely have to. And so if we can use incentives to build people's motivation, so to speak, or move them closer to that enjoyment end of the continuum, then we know that incentives are working. But even more importantly, they're not harming people, and they're setting them up for independent, incentive-free exercise in the future, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. How does what people do the incentives, the impact of the incentives, have any dependence on what the exercise is? In other words, bike riding or, you know, doing things that people think of as recreational versus going to boot camp, which I actually think of as recreational, but not everybody does.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. I haven't heard that one before. So does the type of the exercise or behavior influence the impact of the incentive, I guess? And so my answer based on some of the reading I've done, I guess, would be yes, because incentives do impact different behaviors and outcomes differently. For example, another review that was published a couple of years ago found that incentives were more effective when they were targeting behaviors as opposed to outcomes like weight loss.
Okay.
So if a behavior is really hard, like a really intense workout, for example, a $5 voucher to a coffee shop might not be motivation enough for some people. Whereas if they actually are more likely to enjoy that activity, then it might be enough to tip the scale towards, you know, making that decision.
And you've mentioned the $5 gift card type of thing. Does hard cold cash work better than that for some people in some situations?
Yeah, I think generally from the evidence, cash is king because you can spend it anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you're the one who's paying out these incentives and you're concerned about the cost of an incentive program, you might be able to save some money by offering voucher-based incentives instead for two reasons. One, because they might be perceived as more meaningful to your target group. And the other is private companies might be willing to donate at least part of that voucher in an effort to, you know, advertise their company or recruit new customers.
All of this isn't just about the altruism of getting somebody in a healthier place. The research is being funded and is the most sought after by employers and health insurance companies.
Yes. Not so much in Canada, of course, because we've got more of a universal healthcare system.
Right.
But definitely in the States, because it's in their best interest to keep their employees healthy, not only from a healthcare utilization perspective, but also increase productivity. So helping employers and big and small companies implement these incentives in a better way using smarter financial health incentive design is the way to go. And it's why I'm so excited about this field of research, because it really is in its infancy right now. It's more than just paying somebody. It's how you do it and who you target and that sort of thing.
The big incentive at OSU is that you have this biometric screening done, and then you get a discount on your premiums for the year that adds up to about $300. So it's not insignificant. But you don't have to exercise or anything. Basically, they're giving you information about yourself.
Yeah, and you get the incentive for participating in that screening.
Yeah,
is that what you mean?
Yeah, and the screening itself it's not exercise, but it tells you a lot about yourself and maybe inspires exercise, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, my understanding is that some insurers are providing incentives for just the act of participating in screening.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, others are adding additional incentives if you meet certain targets, which is a little bit tricky because, for example, a lot of the patients that I work with at Toronto Rehab, they can commit themselves to a fairly vigorous exercise program, but not lose a pound or not have their blood pressure go down at all. Mm-hmm. And you kind of have to expect that because everybody responds to exercise differently. So to offer incentives for outcomes can be a little bit dangerous because some people can engage in all these wonderful activities but not see the results. So I'm a fan of providing incentives for behaviors instead, and health risk screening, health risk assessment would be one of those, because as you say, that in itself can be a motivator.
Tess in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Tess.
Yes, I have been going to the gym, you know, 4 or 5 times a week for 30 years, and it's still hard to go some days. I mean, you know, a lot of times it's counterintuitive for human beings to, in many ways, to exercise, because we still think we should, you know, save up our energy for when a bear is chasing us. And, right? So,
yeah.
You know, it's hard to do. And there's 2 things I do that work for me really well. One is that I've made it non-negotiable in my mind. I just tell myself it's non-negotiable. There's just like, you don't have a choice. I just say to myself, this is a non-negotiable thing. You can't not do it. It's non-negotiable.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell myself it's non-negotiable. That helps. Another thing I do then, this is probably the most effective one, is that I just tell myself, if I'm really having a hard time that day and I'm putting it off, and I just say, okay, just get in the car and drive towards the gym. That's all you have. That's the only commitment you have to make right now. Because, you know, once you get to the gym, nobody gets to the gym and says, well, now I'm here, but I'm not going to work out, right? You know, you got there already, so of course you're going to do it. But it, mentally, just getting over that hump of going to the gym is, you know, a big deal it sometimes. So I do that, too. And that's probably over many, many, many years continues. I use it at least a couple of times a week, I would say.
Hey, Tess, can you remember back 30 years ago when you first started, though? Was it easier? How did you first get into the habit?
I was going to OSU, and they used to have the aerobics there in the old gym. And I started going to that, and I really liked that. And that was how I started.
Hmm.
And then I like the results, and, you know, I don't want to look bad. I think it's also vanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we have a choice as to how we age. You know, nobody can look like they're 25 when they're 50, but maybe you can look 40. Right.
It's just a house of cards for me. I don't know. It's just to hold the joints together at this point. But
yeah, I mean, I think it's vanity too. Huh. And then also, I just wanted to say, you know, in Ohio, where we have a lot of warmer weather, unlike your guests, I really think that if I've also been a group fitness instructor and many different types of things over the years, although I injured myself a few years ago, so I don't really do much of it. But in addition to that, I still went to the gym and, you know, lifted weights and things, because you can't rely on teaching for your fitness regime. So I think that if more businesses, even if you're a business and you can't afford to underwrite a gym or you can't afford to put in a gym, if they would just put in a shower, because people could go out and walk, you know, or ride their bikes or whatever at lunch. But a big deal is, let's say you're working at a call center or you're working at a, you know, little business. You don't want to go out and go for a brisk walk and come back all sweaty and gross and not be able to clean up. And that would be a small, you know, relatively inexpensive thing to do, to just put in some kind of little locker room with a shower so that people could go out and mm-hmm. exercise more vigorously and come back and get cleaned up. And then last, then I'll hang up and listen to the comments, but last, I agree with the way Ohio State does things, because, you know, giving people an incentive through a discount also, you know, rewards the people that are working hard for paying less. And yes, it does penalize the people who won't, but doing it by a biometric screening so that they can be given effective tools on how to fix their health. Then if they still won't, even after they're given the tools, they won't do it. It's not fair for an employee like you and to underwrite somebody who just won't do it. And so, you know, I think that doing it that way is a really effective tool.
Well, thanks for calling,
okay.
Tess. All right.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Lots of information there. What is there anything in the literature, Mark Mitchell, about incentivizing people with resources, the shower, for instance, or doing yoga classes somewhere in the office?
Yeah, it's the evidence is a bit more limited with that, but I've noticed in the literature, even in the last 12 months, more and more people are starting to offer those services or vouchers. So I think that's probably the way things are going, just because that would probably be a more affordable way of offering these types of incentives.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us.
Oh, not a problem. It's my pleasure.
Mark Mitchell, he is one of the co-authors of a new article. It's a review of the financial incentives for exercise adherence in adults. It's published yesterday in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. We'll continue Wellness Wednesday after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It looks like our next guest is unable to show up, so we can continue our conversation about what you do to incentivize yourself, what kind of incentives maybe you get at work, maybe through your insurance company. How do you motivate yourself to exercise? We all know we have to do more of it to get healthy. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also use our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. And JR in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, JR.
Yes. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Love your show, and I think that incentivizing and advocating for employees to take responsibility for their better health makes a tremendous amount of sense. However, there is one large employer here in Columbus, at least one, who penalizes their employees financially for not participating in a program through a third party with no guarantee of privacy for your health care information. My wife's employer actually docks her pay $10 a paycheck for not participating in a third-party healthcare management company that offers no guarantee of privacy on what happens to this database. But better still, they penalize for an additional $10 because I do not participate. This isn't my employer. What obligation should I have to reveal information about my medical history to a third company, not my insurance company, not the insurance that's offered through Nationwide, mm-hmm. but to a third party who is presumably data mining this information for purposes that are not being disclosed? And do I have concerns about employment discrimination if I'm looking for a job somewhere else, that there's an entry of any health conditions that I have that's out there for sale, and I would never be the wiser?
So hypothetically,
it's one thing to incentivize, it's another thing to penalize for non-participation, especially for a spouse. I mean, ask for our kids' health information next and tack on another $20 every paycheck because we don't want to share their health history information with a third party?
Okay, JR, let me ask you a question. Are you saying that even, like, say, hypothetically, you and your wife are engaging in a program, but you just don't wish to do it through their third party because you don't want the access to your information?
Correct.
And you'll still get docked, even though you may be engaging in the behavior they want. You're not doing it through the vendor that they want you to go through.
Correct. You have to go through their company, and whether they have a revenue stream that comes from this information that they're gathering, whether mm-hmm. or not this is entirely altruistic but does not have sufficient privacy, disclosure,
you don't
and
know.
Controls, none of that information is provided. All I know is that $20 comes out of every single paycheck, and while there is some condition of employment that they can impose that says, hey, you do this, or we dock your pay.
Right.
Instead, they're actually putting it in that if spouses don't participate in a company they don't work for, then they actually dock my wife's pay.
But even if you're not, that's because you're insured under your wife, right?
But this has nothing to do with our insurance. Our insurance premiums don't change at all.
Huh.
It actually comes from a third party.
Gotcha.
It's not our insurance company.
Okay.
It's not information that's shared with our physician.
This comes right out of your pay.
It doesn't seem to pass the legal smell test, to be honest.
That's interesting, JR. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
All right. Take care. My next guest didn't show up. We're going to continue our conversation about what you do to incentivize yourself, what kind of incentives your employer or your insurer may offer, how you get out there and exercise. We all the discussion's over about whether it's good for you or not. We all know that we have to do it. What do you do to make it work for you? I'm going to turn to Tom in Columbus now. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah, I appreciate the topic. One thing that I try to do is combine different functions, you know, that everybody has to do, routine tasks, okay? So, you know, if I need to go to the grocery store, which is only half a mile away, and I go there, you know, every couple days, a lot of times I'll walk and carry my groceries back.
Good for you.
That's bucking the system, because Americans in general, I think more than any other culture, we don't like to be seen in public doing routine chores or tasks, because then we appear to be somehow less important, you know, a lower class human, that kind of thing, all right? Underprivileged, you know, what's wrong with, or they, if they know we have cars and we don't drive them, then people sometimes say, what's wrong with him?
Mm-hmm.
Well, on the other hand, you do hear people say, you know, that guy only lives a block from the store and he drives,
mm-hmm.
you know, so we got this thing going back and forth. But till we get over that, because if you don't walk and you drive, then you're less able to walk the next time.
Hmm.
And it's a vicious cycle. So either you're going up or you're going down the cycle. And that's all I got to say.
All right, Tom. Thanks for your call.
Yep. Bye.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday, and I just want to hear from listeners now about what you do to incentivize yourself. How do you motivate yourself to exercise? We know we need to do it. That discussion's over with. How do you do it? We have to do something. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. I'm not sure I can answer your question, but maybe someone out there can. Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I was saying that if it's not within walking distance or 5 to 10 minutes away from where I live in the car, it's not going to happen. I just know myself too well. It's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I started with taking a West African dance class when I lived in Victorian Village, because it was right across the street, and it just sounded really cool, and I just went in.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that, and then I moved. And now I went down to the dance center, and I thought I was going to be taking one class, but I didn't. And I really made the effort, and I actually liked it. And the instructor was very responsive to my needs. And also, I have 2 dogs and no yard. So we go on frequent walks.
And are you a good pet owner, is the question?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Some people think I spoil my pets.
But giving them a walk is the best thing that you can do for them and you.
Yep.
Okay. Beth, okay. Thanks a lot for your call.
Okay. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Once again, 614-292-8513. We will get to your call. I know someone's out there ringing, so hang in there. Speaking of dogs, Joellen in Alexandria, you're on the air. Welcome, Joellen.
I'm so sorry. I'm repeating what you guys were just talking
That's
about.
That's okay.
For those of us who love the companionship of other species, I really think it's enjoyable getting exercise, doing a fast-paced walk with dogs. They get so much out of it, and it really helps us, too.
And it's a regular thing they need every day.
Yes, and that's incentive when they look at you and they say, okay, I'm ready. It's hard to say no.
That's your exercise buddy right there, huh?
Yes, you got it.
Okay, Joellen, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Debbie in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. About 15 years ago, I worked for a company that was well-meaning, but they didn't quite think it out. At one point, I had been a few pounds heavier, and I had lost my own quite a bit of weight through my own 4 to 5 mile walk most every day. And my employer knew about it, so it wasn't a big secret. But they wanted still some kind of a encourage, some kind of a new walk for our group. And I told him very nicely, I said, I don't mind walking, but I don't want to come back smelly, you know, and have my clients complain that as a professional, you know, I'm not clean and fresh smelling. So he had a little bit of an attitude, but then he realized I had a point. And I did notice that my office mate, who did do the walk, had a little bit of body odor afterwards. So I kind of stuck to my guns, but continued my own walk.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the idea of a gym and the ability to change into fresh clothes is very important, because when you work with the public, you don't want people calling, complaining, and say he's not there to clean the problem up. Say they complain higher up.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say, well, I encourage her to do this, so let's not blame her for that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's my kind of comment. That's
yeah,
all.
For a lot of people, that's that one time of the day when they have some, what they can do is when they can do it. It's lunchtime. And or people who want to ride their bike to work have the same problem, too.
Well, that was my comment. That was mm-hmm. all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. 614-292-8513. What do you do to stay in shape? Not just what do you do to stay in shape, but how do you motivate yourself to stay in shape? Jody in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Jody.
Hi.
Are you there?
I am.
All right. You're on the air. That's okay.
I wanted to take it off speaker. Hi, Ann. It's
hi.
Jody, and I'm with Consider Biking. So we support.
Well, hi, Jody.
Hi, getting people out there on bikes for
right.
transport and sport. But my comment is really in response to JR. In a previous life, I was a health coach with one of those third-party providers, and you know, we talked to people about their health goals and supported them, and it was a I guess a supportive thing, not a spying thing. And the other piece is, you know, he said, oh, it has no relation to my healthcare premiums. And it has everything to do with the healthcare premiums, because the people that won't participate, I mean, he may say that he's doing it on the side, but when people are being provided complimentary and they've got professional help on a regular basis, those are the people that are achieving their health goals, which are avoiding health care expenses, which, you know, brings the premiums down.
What about his fear of that third-party access to the information thing?
Well, you could say the same thing about his doctor.
Hmm.
I mean, why is a professional health coaching company more likely to violate HIPAA than your doctor or a social worker or all the other people in the system? So I would say it's unfounded, but I would also say, is there a reason that you don't want to address a health concern or health goal? You know, I mean, it's resistance. There's a reason that people need health coaching, because it's something that they haven't achieved on their own, I would
mm-hmm.
say.
Okay. All right, Jody.
Yeah. Ride bikes.
Thank right. you, Jody. Take care.
Bye bye.
Jacina in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jacina.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about a video game that my husband and I play called Ingress, Ingress. And there are fake portals all over the city, and we walk and ride our bikes and play this video game, and it keeps us motivated.
Yeah, I think I've heard of that. It's you scan something when you've
yeah.
arrived or something like that. I think we've
yeah,
had it on Tech Tuesday.
It's pretty complicated to explain on the air, but
yeah.
it's great fun. And every day I run through the Park of Roses and during my lunch and have a great time.
Okay, it's called Ingress, Ingress.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks
okay.
for the idea, Jacina.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, Scott, this is kind of shallow. What's your comment, Scott?
Well, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I thought, you know, I'm in the dating scene, so I always want to find somebody else who's athletic and looks good. So my motivation is to take care of myself, essentially, so you can find somebody out there who is equally in shape, looks good, at least physically. So
mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe that is kind of sounds shallow, but at the same
I was just kidding. I was just giving
okay.
you a hard time.
But
no.
I think it's perfectly fine to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it makes complete sense. You want to find someone that'll not disincentivize you, someone that'll incentivize you, someone who wants to do it too. So
exactly.
Right. Well, thanks, Scott.
No problem.
Take care.
Yep.
Marcia in Westerville. Hi, Marcia. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Ann. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Good. I've been a certified personal trainer for about a dozen years, but prior to that, there's just so much credence in doing it first thing in the morning before you go to work.
Yep.
You get into your fat stores quicker. You feel good all day long. And if you start the day feeling good, then you're just going to be so motivated to turn a blind eye to all those, you quote, bad things out there for you. You eat well all day long. You hydrate. And if you wait until the end of the day, you're tired and there are so many other things that compete for that little bit of time that you have before you hit the hay at night.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so much better all the way around. You'll get great, great results if you do it first thing.
That's what I usually do, too, for exactly the reasons you mentioned. And there's exercise programs that are getting started earlier and earlier around the city for people who want to, you know, get back and get the kids off to school and stuff like that, too.
Yeah, and even for those people that don't have time to, you know, if you don't want to drive some, you know, get in your car and drive somewhere. I mean, there are a myriad of videotapes mm-hmm. out there that, you know, for all fitness levels, you know, everybody has to have a starting point. So start at the beginning where everybody starts and work your way up and progress and stick with it.
All right, Marcia, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
This is interesting. Hi, Edward in Columbus. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you.
Hey, to stay motivated, I actually I have taken a look at my family tree history of you know, diabetes and high cholesterol, and I come from an overweight family as well, and I'm the small male of five, so it's been a battle for my two brothers and sisters, and I'm being the only lucky one that somehow thanks God, out here in Columbus, we have a lot of things to do. We have the kayaking areas out here.
Mm-hmm.
We have all the parks and recreation. Thanks to Mayor Mike, we have a lot of walkways now for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But, it starts with you. I mean, you have to look at yourself and ask yourself, do you want to feel better tomorrow? It's a process that you have to take the first step, because nobody is one of those things, nobody's going to do it for you.
Yeah, but do you think incentives from workplace and, you know, employers and insurers can help some people?
I think incentives could help many people that actually are less, how you call it, less motivated. I mean, I thank God that I've been motivated myself, but for those less motivated ones, they definitely should have all those available programs. I know that, you know, not everybody is blessed to actually have all the, you know,
mm-hmm.
some jobs actually, you know, offer.
Okay.
Never have been offered any help or nothing, so I have to do it myself. But I think the best thing people can do is just stay positive and look at themselves and ask themselves in the mirror, do they want to feel better tomorrow? And you don't need no company, you don't need no health insurance, all you need is yourself.
Okay. All right. Edward, thanks for your call.
God bless. Have a beautiful day.
Thank you. You too. One more call from David in Clintonville. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, and thanks for taking the call. My big motivation is gas prices. I bike a lot, and, you know, I always tell myself, well, I'm saving money because not using gas, and I'm exercising, and I'm doing something. Big problem with exercise a lot of times for me is that it feels inefficient. I'm sitting here exercising. I could be, you know, running to the store to do this or that. And this way I'm able to do errands and save a little gas. And that
right.
double motivation seems to really help me.
Yeah, that gas price. It's a financial motivation, but that's okay. Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, David. Take care. From email from Isaac writes, a big motivator for me is not just feeling great physically, but I find that after a good run at the gym, I feel much better mentally. I have recently started running, with my ultimate goal being running a half marathon. So my motivation is running those 13.1 miles and in the near future, a full marathon. Good luck to you, Isaac. Coming up, we're going to continue our series on the Affordable Care Act. This time we're going to talk about the potential or the upcoming shortage of physicians. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're continuing our series on the Affordable Care Act starting in January. An estimated 32 million more Americans will have health insurance by way of the Affordable Care Act. What the act did not do, however, was mandate millions more doctors, which raises the question, who is going to care for all of the newly insured? Joining us to talk about that is William Burke. He's dean of the Ohio University Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine in Dublin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Do we have a sense of how serious the doctor shortage will be in Ohio?
Well, you know, absolutely. We have an idea nationwide. For example, we're talking about nearly 40,000 doctors short in 2015 and going up to, you know, 63,000 to 66,000, you know, physicians, you know, over that next decade. While the number in Ohio specifically, I don't have that information. I can tell you that we're not nearly as bad off as some other states, though. We're, you know, we understand that nearly one in five Americans live in a region that's designated as already having a shortage of primary care. Well, right now, that's about one in 10 in Ohio.
Does that tend to be rural areas?
It does. Rural tends to be the area that most folks focus on, but we also need to remember that there are many areas within our urban communities that are underserved as well.
Kind of like the food deserts, we have healthcare deserts.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, interesting enough, we talk about health professions shortage areas. You know, there are 28 of those in central Ohio, you know, with Franklin, its contiguous counties, but 23 are in Franklin County itself. So you don't have to go very far to find difficulty.
What defines a shortage area?
You know, a shortage area is where they look at the ratio of, you know, physicians, you know, to that population, you know, in that area. And, you know, unfortunately, when you look at some of our suburbs, they're not such a big deal, but you don't find very many doctors, you know, downtown, in the Hilltop area, and places of that nature.
And that's exactly where people don't have as much of the means to travel long distances to see doctors.
Exactly right. They're relying on public transportation, you know, or, you know, walking, biking, doing what they can on their own.
So besides more physicians, are there other ways to address the shortage?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that is being addressed is the addition of other healthcare providers, such as physician assistants, you know, nurse practitioners, you know, who work with physicians as members of the team to provide care. But one of the challenges that we're seeing in those areas is no different than what we're seeing in the physician population, that not as many of those folks are going into primary care.
Oh, they're specializing.
Yes, that's correct. You may have a physician's assistant who works in the area of dermatology or others. So, you know, the economics that impact physicians are also impacting these extenders as well.
Meaning if you're a specialist, you earn more money.
That is correct.
So one part of the problem, lack of residency spots for doctors after graduating, it sounds like a bottlenecking problem. How can that be addressed? How can there not be enough places for doctors to get that training they need?
Well, currently, that's a, you know, multi-pronged problem. If we were to look only at graduates of U.S. medical schools, you know, there would be enough residencies for everybody and are at this point. But when you add international medical graduates that also come in, and the distribution is the other piece of this, that is, you know, we have many more students that are interested in going into these subspecialty fields and leaving areas open in our primary care disciplines, such as family medicine, general pediatrics, and general internal medicine. So one of the issues is that we have to address at a federal level the way hospitals and other entities are reimbursed for the development of new residency programs, because hospitals that already have residency programs are essentially under a cap and cannot add additional residencies without having to absorb that cost themselves.
My guest is William Burke. He's dean of the Ohio University Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine in Dublin. We're talking about the ongoing shortage of physicians and the uptick or the increase in that shortage. That kind of sounds like they don't belong in the same sentence. But anyways, when the Affordable Care Act goes into effect in January, if you have a question or comment for Dr. Burke, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is the shortage concern for primary care physicians only, or is there also a worry about specialists, even though people, you know, more people go into those fields? Is there still a shortage?
Yes, you know, primary care is certainly one of the most important issues because that's the primary access that patients have initially. But there are concerns about shortages in specialties, and as we talked about earlier, the distribution. Again, not so difficult to find a cardiologist in Columbus, Ohio, but if you go out to a smaller community, that may be difficult.
And there's also the issue of the expansion of Medicaid. Now, in Ohio, it looks as bleak as it does anywhere in the country right now. The federal government, of course, has offered 3 years. The federal government would cover 3 years of the expansion and then 90% of the expansion thereafter. But the state of Ohio at this point, it's up in the air. We don't know. But if it did happen, one of the existing problems, too, is that there aren't enough people out there who can afford to treat Medicaid patients.
You know, that is a challenge, and there's no doubt about that. But I do believe that there are ways for us to overcome that hurdle. You know, physicians are in the business of medicine to take care of patients, and they want to do everything that they can to help. And one of the most discouraging things as a family physician myself is to see those people that fall through the cracks currently. They are working. They're working hard. Maybe both members, you know, the husband and wife, are working, and they do not have insurance. And so they wait until it's too late, or they wait until it becomes much more expensive because there's, you know, more testing and treatment that needs to be done. So I think all of us benefit, you know, by having the general population covered, because one way or another, we're all paying for this.
Are there a lot of people that would like to go into primary care, but after they get a gander at what the cost of medical school is going to be, they just can't afford it?
Well, I think that is one of the issues that we're dealing with. You know, there are multiple reasons why, you know, students do not choose primary care residencies. But when you ask them, you know, the idea of salary from a primary care physician standpoint, you know, compared to a subspecialist, is something that's particularly important, because right now the average medical student debt is nearing $200,000. You know, it's going to be, you know, the largest home they've ever bought that they can't live in.
Ohio University recently announced a partnership with Ohio Dominican University to address this problem. Tell us about that and how it'll work.
Yes, yeah, at a very exciting program with Ohio Dominican called our Early Assurance Program. And it's a way to identify, you know, outstanding students at the high school level, you know, who are getting ready to enter college. There's a minimum GPA that they're required and minimum scores on ACTs or SATs and some requirements that they have to do. But it gives them an opportunity to pursue either what we call a 4+4 program, where you do your 4 years of undergrad and 4 years of medical school, or, you know, do your 3 years in the undergraduate level, and that fourth year, it counts as your first year of medical school. You know, we're having a maximum of 10 of these EAP students that will be guaranteed admission to the Ohio University Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine if they successfully, you know, do their work at Ohio Dominican.
Now, this sounds pretty rigorous. How do you identify who would fit into this program?
Well, clearly you're looking for those individuals, you know, that have the academic expertise and skills. But when we're talking about primary care as well, you know, there are a lot of other attributes that we consider. You know, folks that are first-time college students are more likely to go into primary care specialties. Individuals that come from small communities or underserved areas in larger communities are more likely to go into primary care. We know that people like women are more likely to choose primary care than men. Minorities, you know, are more likely to select family medicine. And I think for a lot of these reasons, because these individuals may have been exposed to the fact that it was hard to find care as they were growing up.
I know Ohio Dominican works with the Graham School. It's a high school, a charter school in town, to get kids, a lot of first-time, you know, or first-generation college students into college and get them through college. So how deeply do you go? Are you going into the high schools to tap them at that point, or is Ohio Dominican doing that?
Well,
how does that work?
Yeah, we'll be working on that project together, you know, absolutely, as part of the, we have a group, a collaborating group that works together on processes and procedures. But, you know, there is no doubt that we need to be touching students, you know, at an earlier age. So it's not just the college students anymore, but looking for those young men and women in high school that have an interest in medicine. Madison and letting them know that this is still an incredible field, you know, which we are very, very blessed to be a part of.
Is it just directed at high school students who know they want to be doctors, or are you trying to recruit kids who don't know they want to be doctors but have the, you know, the acumen for it?
Yeah, and that's a great question, too. I mean, there are some individuals that know what they want to do from a very young age, and others that just need a little bit of guidance and support. And so I think that's what both Ohio Dominican and the Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine will be looking to do.
Ohio University is opening up two new medical campuses, one in Dublin and one near Cleveland. How will the student experience be different from the main med school in Athens?
Yeah, that's a great question as well, because the atmosphere will be different. You know, when you're talking about it being affiliated with a major state university in Athens, Ohio, versus a smaller campus in Columbus and or Cleveland, you know, there will be some differences in that atmosphere. But, you know, I certainly expect we have certainly planned, you know, that the individuals on both the Dublin campus and Cleveland will have as good an education as the students that would be based in Athens, and also recognizing that each campus itself will have something that's just a little bit different. You know, the Dublin campus and the Cleveland campus will have, you know, more access to subspecialists, which sounds, you know, counterintuitive, but a good primary care doctor needs to have a well-balanced education in all of the areas. One of the other things that we will be doing is utilizing, you know, the latest in distance technology, as we have lectures and presentations going from Athens to Columbus or from Cleveland to Dublin, you know, or vice versa, mm-hmm. but still making sure that we have the opportunity to work very carefully and closely in small group learning atmosphere with faculty that are live on campus.
Speaking of distance technology, from where you sit as Dean of the Ohio University Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine in Dublin, how much do you look into the future and see technology being used to fill some of those gaps through long-distance communication?
We know it's interesting, Anne, that there are a couple of groups out there that, you know, beyond things like, you know, the minute clinics and having, you know, folks available where patients are, there's a concept, you know, called the medical pod. Yeah, where a patient will go into this pod unit, and via video conferencing technology, there is a physician or a physician's assistant or nurse practitioner on the other end, and the patient can simply put a stethoscope up to their chest in that pod, and a physician, you know, can hear the results of the, you know, whether it's listening to the heart or the lung, and also being able to look at things like the ears as well.
What can be done realistically to keep Ohio-educated doctors in this state when they graduate?
Yeah, clearly we have to do a number of things. One, if we choose individuals who are from Ohio, they are more likely to stay in Ohio and train. You know, and Ohio University's Heritage College has had, you know, wonderful success in that. We're all, nearly 60% of our graduates, you know, are practicing in Ohio, and 50% of them are, you know, are practicing primary care. This year, the class of 140 young men and women in Athens, Ohio, over 90% of them are from the state of Ohio. So if you choose those young men and women that are likely to stay, but we also have to find opportunities to help reduce that debt. So through scholarships, particularly for those that may enter primary care, is another way to help.
And what about, you know, the idea of working off your debt in an underserved area?
Absolutely. There are a number, what we mentioned earlier, those health professional shortage areas. Mm-hmm. There are loan repayment programs for students that go and promise to practice in those areas for a certain period of time. So there are a lot of both old and, you know, newly innovative ways that we can look to get those physicians where they are needed and to, you know, to encourage them to stay there.
Is there anything that you know of in the Affordable Care Act that addresses this issue and is working on it?
Well, there are a couple of things in the Affordable Care Act. One in particular, and we mentioned this before, with the need for additional residency slots,
right,
or what are called these teaching health centers. And so, again, you might be able to utilize a community health center as a place to be a base for training primary care physicians, as opposed to a large academic medical center. You know, so you get a better idea of what it's going to be like when you're sitting in that community, that underserved community, and doing your training there, at least in regard to the continuity where you're seeing patients on a regular basis.
I was thinking when you said that there's more access to subspecialists if you're working or learning in an area like, you know, the suburbs of Columbus, but also there's more access to the sort of big city trauma centers that are here.
Well, absolutely right. And, you know, that's a positive for the students here as well. But, you know, again, a primary care doc, particularly if he or she is working in a smaller community, needs to feel confident in their abilities to deal with just about anything, you know, to know what they can handle and what they need to refer. And by seeing things like the trauma and the subspecialty, it helps them to become better primary care physicians.
Well, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. We really appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure, Ann.
It's William Burke. He's Dean of the Ohio University Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine in Dublin. Thanks to everybody for listening today on Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media. Bye.
Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.